It's a sign that spring might finally be here, that we have such a wonderful turnout today, I guess. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Nick Lemon, the Dean of Columbia Journalism School. I'm performing my traditional role as very, very brief welcomer and introducer. I want to thank, as I always do, our sponsors and supporters, in particular, the lead sponsor, Peter Thonis of Verizon. I also, before we start, want to introduce somebody. If you could stand up, Jeff Richard. He's our new Associate Dean for Development and Alumni Relations at the Journalism School. Please give him a warm welcome. He came on March 1st, so he's in the position I was in 6 months ago, where everything he's doing for the first time, and this is his first First Amendment breakfast. Now, as per custom, I will turn the proceedings over to Floyd Abrams.
Thank you, Nick, and welcome, everybody. It does feel like springtime. Our topic today is entitled Business Journalism, Does the Press Get It? We meet at an especially difficult time for the press. The addition of USA Today to the growing list of publications that have uncovered, investigated, and then publicly disclosed a scandal relating to their own journalistic coverage is just the latest example of an extraordinarily grim time with respect to press credibility. Sunday's New York Times listed a few post-Jason Blair problems I hadn't even heard about. The dismissal or punishment of journalists at the Vancouver Sun for near plagiarism of the Times itself, a journalist at an Iowa newspaper being dismissed for publishing a suspiciously similar film review to one in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I could go on and on. Add to that the sagging ratings people give the press when asked about its competence or fairness, and you have a time of extraordinary press vulnerability. Last week, a 500-page report was issued by the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which contains, among much else, a recent Pew Research Council Center poll, which found that 56% of the people polled believe that news organizations often report inaccurately, and only 20% of the public rated newspapers as believable, a figure down 8 points from 1985, when that question was last asked. An article in Sunday's Washington Post by Paul Ferry sort of mocks the report, pointing out that asking people their opinion of the news media, or even television news, was like asking them their opinion of lawyers. It was an abstraction, he said, and one that invites reflexive, generic cynicism. I don't think journalists ought to take any comfort in the fact that the public's response to the question may not have been as thoughtful as journalists might hope. The question is what the public thinks, and the answer is that what it thinks is not good. Beyond that, any group of people that is compared to lawyers is in trouble. Today we meet to talk about an area in which the press has often been criticized by those people who are being reported on and those institutions which are being reported on. I remember attending a conference in the 1980s run by Fred Friendly, one of Fred's marvelous confrontations between people viewing the same subject from so very different perspectives. This one was about the press coverage of business, and one of the speakers was the chairman of AT&T, who got up and complained about the fact that a news report in a prominent publication had been written by a journalist who, he said, did not know the difference between a stock and a bond, and therefore had written things about AT&T's financial results, which led to a meltdown of their stock by over $1 billion in a 2-hour period. for some reason he was upset. My favorite moment, incidentally, at that conference, and Ruth Friendly, who joins us today, will remember it well, came the night before it began, when Friendly told all the participants after dinner that they should get an early night's sleep, not to take any drugs, because it might have early morning effects. He then turned to the chief executive officer of the company that made Valium and asked him if he ever took it. And the man's answer was, if you make Valium, you don't have to take Valium. Today we're going to talk about the sort of things that people complain about in business journalism and the sort of complaints journalists have about those who do the complaining. Let me offer one of my own. Eve Burton, who assembled this distinguished panel today, made a lot of calls to prominent public companies asking if they would provide someone to be on this panel. They spoke with her at length and responsively, often very critically of the press, but all declined to appear today, some of them telling Eve that their legal and public relations department had warned them against appearing on the panel. Now, on one level, that makes a sort of sense. I can certainly hear a smart PR person asking, why in the world would we want to be on a panel dissing the press? And who wants anyone to think about us all, about our company at all, in the context of critical commentary that the press may have made about us? And why in the world would we want the press to be against us, or more against us, as it's often viewed? I understand that, but it's still disturbing that so many high-powered, high-class, serious American companies that I know have complaints about press coverage are unwilling to come forward and be heard. I encourage all of you today to think about questions as the panel goes on and be ready to ask our panelists questions. Our first order of business, though, before we get to questions, is to listen to our very distinguished panel. We have three people here today who approach this from different perspectives and different backgrounds. We'll hear first from Davia Temin. Davia is the president of Temin & Company, Incorporated, International Strategic Marketing, Branding, and Public Affairs Council. Temin & Company helps corporations and other institutions define and strengthen their public image and identity through strategic marketing and positioning, media relations and training, advertising, financial communications, crisis management, and communications. One of those things I will pause on, she helps prepare people to talk to the press, and we will ask her if she helps prepare people not to respond to the press. Prior to starting Temin & Company, she was corporate vice president and head of corporate marketing at General Electric Capital Services, and we look very much to listening to her and learning from her. We'll hear next from Barney Kanaim. Barney is the deputy managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. His responsibilities include the final reading of the paper's page one, taking charge of the journal in the absence of the managing editor. Barney came to the journal in September 1965 and has performed a wide range of services in a variety of places for the journal. He was honored in 2002 by the Society of American Business Editors and Writers with their Distinguished Achievement Award. And then we'll hear from Judy Dobrinsky, who joined CNBC as managing editor in March 2003. In that position, she's responsible for directing coverage of the news, running the assignment desk, supervising the work of over 50 editors, reporters, and on-air editors and producers, both at CNBC headquarters and the network's bureaus around the country. She comes to CNBC from The Times, where she was most recently the editor of the Sunday Money and Business section and the deputy business editor. Previously, she was a reporter in the cultural section of The Times, and before that, she worked at Business Week. So we're delighted to have them together, and why don't we start with Davia?
Good morning. Well, it's rather a challenge to be here today in the chair that no one from the corporate world wants to fill, because really I think they have a fear of a seeming confrontation with the press, and especially with the Wall Street Journal and CNBC, in open air, probably instead of bashing them in private, as they always do. But there's a sucker born every minute, as they say, and while I've had a fairly good track record of experience with the press's coverage of companies with whom I've been working, I do relish the role of agent provocateur, and so here goes. I understand the reticence of the corporate executives who wouldn't be here today in one sense, because no matter how fair anyone tries to be, human biases always play a role in judgment. I believe that's true for the press who cover business, just as it is true for every professional, and certainly for the professionals who talk to the press representing business. The stakes are very high for corporations, especially when they're covered by the media. We all know the power of the business media to move markets, to make or break companies, as well as the individuals and the careers of individual executives within those companies. But what I don't think that the press knows, and arguably shouldn't know, is just how much power seemingly meaningless stories within the press have within organizations. Let me give you an example. I was at General Electric when the succession race for Jack's spot was just beginning. Very, very early in the game, a publication wrote an article that was speculating on some dark horse candidates for Jack's throne. The list that they published was absolutely unbelievable. It was, for anyone within the organization or who had any real knowledge of the organization, ridiculous. Not one of the people who was mentioned there was a serious contender. But when it came out, that article, in a very small world that was GE, where it's almost like Kremlin watching, it irreparably damaged the careers of most of the people who were mentioned. And it was talked about for months and months and months. To the publication, it might have been a seemingly meaningless little, you know, beginning of coverage. But within the organization, it was terribly damaging. There was so much attention to the story within GE, it was posited that some of the people who were mentioned were trying to position themselves internally by manipulating the press. A very un-GE thing to do, and carrying with it dire sanctions. That indeed, by the way, was not true, because I finally did figure out how it happened, and none of those who were mentioned had anything to do with it. But regardless, they simply had no credibility left within the organization, at least for a very long time. And some of them may still be there, but they have spent years making up for that one little press mention. Now, I'm sure the reporter and his editors would have been appalled to have known the repercussions of that one little story. But many organizations are like an echo chamber, and one press mention bounces off the walls hundreds of times, amplifying with each bounce. Another story of unintended consequences. In March of 2000, at the apogee of the biotech boom and the race between the Human Genome Project and Celera to sequence the human genome, a political miscommunication caused markets, biotech and then NASDAQ, to take a plunge that wiped out hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of value in one day. On that day, President Clinton and Prime Minister Blair were to issue a joint statement calling for free access to raw sequencing of data. They did not say that they wanted to abolish patent protection for genes or intellectual property. Quite. But what they wanted, they were trying to shame Celera into sharing information free with the world scientists in a timely fashion. The rub came when Joe Lockhart, in an early morning briefing, and you know these briefings, they're quite free-for-all and free-form, sandwiched between NRA issues and the First Lady's travel schedule, was asked about the upcoming announcement. He tried to duck it by saying, well, he really wasn't an expert in this field, and he didn't really know, and he didn't understand biotech that well, but he was pushed and pushed and pushed. And he finally allegedly misspoke and said that he thought they wanted to curtail some patent protection, maybe. Well, of course, the press who were there jumped on his words. It was supposed to be an off-the-record briefing, but they jumped on it. It got reported early on by ABC, and then more press jumped on that, and more press jumped on that. And by the time the statement was actually issued, Solera was down 21%, Insight down 27%, and the rest of the bio market just plummeted, and the NASDAQ. Of course, that was not what the Clinton-Blair statement said. The market stayed down nonetheless, and it was moved by a misstatement that was widely reported by the press. Now, I'm not saying it was the press's fault in this particular instance. I actually don't think it was. But this is just to talk about the power of the press, which we all know. Okay, so much for the power. Now for its abuse. And of course, we all know that there is abuse on every side. There are, and for every Enron, for every group of corporate executives who lie or commit sins of commission, omission, or spin, there's a new one, there are reporters who do the same thing. So, as I've said, I've had my share of tough stories, but in the main, in my experience, most of those tough stories were deserved. And it's one thing to take licks that are tough but fair, and it is another to take licks that absolutely aren't fair. So to supplement my share of stories, I played interviewer, and I interviewed a lot of people within the corporate world, those who probably wouldn't come here to speak today, as well as a lot of reporters. And interestingly enough, some of the most credible stories I got of abuses of the press in covering business came from reporters. Who, not themselves, of course, but the guy down the row or someone else, they could point out and say this was really a very unfair story. So, from what my reporting tells me, errors committed by reporters can come under a broad range of causes, including, to not put too fine a point on it, ambitiousness, spin, bias, dirty tricks, laziness, outright dishonesty, lack of knowledge, gullibility, and yes, even the worst of all, stupidity. Obviously, I can't give you stories for each of these stories. You got to have something to react to here, guys, so, you know, we'll just give you these softballs. Okay. Obviously, I can't give you stories for each of these here, but I have them, blinded out, if you will. But I tend to think that the most damage comes in the middle, when there's slight errors of judgment or spin or gullibility that can cause great damage. Let me give you a more obvious example, and this is a case I'm currently involved in right now. I'm going to have to be a little bit guarded in what I say so that you can't figure out too many of the details right away because it's in the middle of a litigation. There's a securities analyst several years ago who put out a sell recommendation on a company he was covering. And this was before it was politically correct to do so. Well, when he did it, the chief executive of the company that he put the sell recommendation on became so incensed, morally, righteously indignant, and the guy's a little sleazy to say the least. First he called up the guy's employer and complained, and the employer stood by him. So he then hired a PR firm, and you know, I'm going to bash a PR firm, and that's sort of what we do too. He hired one to investigate the analyst and to do some character assassination on him. And this PR firm did that. And they found that this analyst held, in a managed account held by a former employer, a stock. There was a stock held in that was a competitor to a stock that he currently covers. Now, forget the fact that it was in a managed account the guy had absolutely no control over it. Forget the fact that his current employer knew all about it. This PR firm went to an investigative journalist, or a team of investigative journalists, and you know what? Those journalists bought this story whole. In their rush to get any kind of investigative scoop they could get, they didn't bother to check with the analysts. They didn't bother to check with anybody. They ran the thing whole. And it was wrong. It was wrong in innuendo, and it was wrong in fact. But indeed, once it was published, the guy was fired because he was such an embarrassment to his employer. And what happened, they ran with it, the unintended consequences was the guy lost his job, and a courageous, correct, if slightly flaky analyst got destroyed. So the matter's in litigation now, as you can suspect, not with the publication, however, and the real denouement is yet to come. So this brings me to my next point. Sometimes I see the press being skeptical and antagonistic with business, where there really is little call to be because the people are being and trying to be quite honest with them. And other times I see the press being totally gullible where they have no right to be. Let's go back to the GE story to finish. That same reporter, when he wrote the misleading succession article, it turned out that he had totally believed an internal source within GE who seemed to be speaking honestly but wasn't. It turned out that the guy who was speaking was really trying to court favor with one of the people he raised up as a possible succession candidate because he wanted to work for that company and that guy's unit. But the reporter believed this guy whole and did not check it with anyone. Later, when I was at GE, as I worked more with this reporter, I was amazed, and it was for a very reputable publication. I was amazed that anything I said to him representing GE, he believed. Now, don't get me wrong, my marketing side loved this. But the side of me that values truth, and that believes that the press needs to be incisive was appalled. Open-mouthed gullibility, even for either for scurrilous or credulous reasons, is danger. So the question is, how can we tell which business complaints are sour grapes and which ones are based on real fact and a desire to be treated fairly? Well, that's an editor's obligation to make that call without prejudice one way or the other, and I'm not sure it's always done in the best way it could be. Because for every righteous investigative journalist, there is always another who uses dirty tricks and out-and-out lies to write a story. And the problem is that the reader or viewer will very rarely know what that real story is, or the backstory, so to speak. Thanks.
Thank you, Davia. Let me ask you to take a sort of cosmic overview of the journalistic performance in reporting on business in areas of which you have personal knowledge. Yeah. How have they done, taken as a whole?
I think taken as a whole, it's been quite good. And I wouldn't ever say anything less. I would say that 90% of the coverage is fair, straight on. If they're going to kick you, you probably deserve to be kicked. And, I mean, you know, you've got stories like the Elon story that was in the journal where, you know, the corporate executives, I mean, it was in the, as after Enron, it was, they had a lot of very questionable partnerships that they were putting together. The corporate leadership complained to a fare-thee-well that they were being covered unfairly. Well, it turned out that when things went into it deeper and deeper, they were being covered quite fairly, and it was appropriate stories. So I'd say 90% is on. It's the 10% and maybe then the 2% of the worst that are the killers.
Barney, you're next.
Well, I think what I'll try to do, you can deal with a lot of those. Stupidity is really a tough one. Maybe as questions come up, I can come back to some of that. I would therefore stick with my my two or three thoughts, addressing the question, at least as I see it, as who says we don't get it? Why do they say it? What are the things that are important for us to show that we do get it? And I'm not addressing the ethics of the process, which is a lot of what we've heard, and I would come back to that. One of the biggest problems, if you're covering business news, is the tension between the makeup of your audience, bosses versus buyers, corporate types versus consumers, personal finance versus corporate coverage. And the truth is, good publications try now to do both. In other words, you have to think about what it means at the corporate level, and you have to think about what it means for the consumer. And it's very difficult when you're talking about an increase in the price of steel for all the people who hold shares in steel companies, for the analysts who are recommending steel companies. Wow, that's great. But it's kind of tough then in the Wall Street Journal to turn the corner and talk about what it means for the price of cars or the price of cookware or something like that. And yet you have to deal with that tension if you're going to serve both of those audiences well. Accuracy and completeness are absolutely essential, as we have just heard. When we make a mistake, the people we hurt know exactly, almost down to the penny, how much we hurt them. When you insult or even defame a politician in Washington, it's kind of hard for them to prove what the damage is, all right? But for the people we write about, and it's an amazing difference. I had worked at the Journal for a few years, and then I went to Washington to be in the bureau there. And the truth is, in Washington, fairness counts, things like that, but people can say things that are not fully substantiated about policy ideas, even about other people. There can be personal things, and you don't hold that coverage to the same standard that we do in business, where the decimal point really makes a difference. And so people have to remember that. And I think that it's also a big obligation to know that you're sitting at your computer and you could really cause some a person of no great means, the widow in Des Moines, to make a wrong decision to call her analyst and insist that he sell or buy something on the basis of what you were writing. And if it's a mistake, that's a lot of responsibility, and a different kind than what David has talked about. I think accounting knowledge is what we really have to have in order to get it. Accounting is the way everything gets discussed underneath. The good stories won't talk so much about accounting, but you've got to know accounting to get the story. And we don't want a bunch of accountants, I think, in all of our business pages, but we want people who have developed accounting expertise, and we're trying very hard with seminars and things like that. I know not just at the Journal, but at other papers, trying to make sure people can decipher what the accountants do. The accountants, by the way, are the greatest sinners, in my opinion, of the last 5 to 8 years. These are people who got paid for their integrity. Just think of the Price Waterhouse guy at the Oscars, you know, when they used to walk out. We believe that that envelope was sealed and had been sealed all the time. Now we know. Accountants and it's not just they volunteered for the job, they were getting paid for it. And what they did, what they have done, I think, is very important to guide us in making changes, and their changes are already happening. And that's not to take the responsibility off of reporters for not fully understanding accounting. It's really important. You have to have a global perspective if you're going to get it. If you're talking to somebody, certainly at Chrysler, now part of a company based in Germany, if you're going to cover any part of the U.S. automobile industry and not be aware or not know how to go find out what Nissan or Toyota are doing, your reader is going to be misserved. The global perspective in an industry like autos, pharmaceuticals, is crucial, and your stories are not complete, and they're likely to be seriously flawed if you don't understand the global perspective and have sources that you can go to who have the global perspective. Finally, one of the lessons that has nothing to do with expertise, it has to do with experience, is the old rule that if it's too good to be true, it probably isn't. That's a rule that in our newsrooms we too often forgot in the late 90s. I look back, I can see it in decisions that I personally made or the proposals that I made. My opinions didn't reflect enough of that, and I've been around a long time. And some of our younger staff members, not having been through this, raised even fewer questions about how could this be true. And it's a good rule when you're trying to show that you get it. It doesn't have to do with your knowledge of accounting or anything else. It's just to keep saying to yourself, if this investment idea, if the performance of this company seems too good to be true, it probably isn't.
Thank you, Barney. I wanted to just ask you to talk a little more. You used the words about journalists fully understanding accounting presentations and other aspects of business performance. Business corporate conduct does seem to me sometimes so difficult to understand fully. I don't mean about hidden balls now, but just because of the level of complexity, the inherent level of complexity of it. I'd just be interested in your sense of the degree to which you think your journalists and others of the top level really do comprehend as they move in a journalistic sense from story to story, business to business, and the like, really do comprehend matters which are extremely difficult from the corporate side to present, and from the journalistic side, I would have thought to really get. Am I exaggerating? Is it as hard as I think it is?
I think it's extremely hard. I think accounting is, I hold it up because I think it's one of the places where we have the greatest difficulty. In the real world, what happens, your first order of business has to be to make sure you've got key people in various pieces of your operation who really do know accounting. You make special efforts with them. You may try to really get them educated. They may already have been someone who took business courses and accounting courses in college, or they've gone back to take a master's degree in business or something. So then you try to make sure that they're known and people can go to them. In other words, in a major bureau or in various components of our New York operation, there are these people. So you need to encourage reporters to go check with this person, because you can't, you could. We have so far been unable to bring everybody's understanding of accounting up to the level where it needs to be. So if you have these pockets, these gurus, these pockets of expertise, that's important. The other thing that you have to have is good sources in accounting, and good sources in the accounting field are hard to come by, and some of the ones who are ready to tear it apart come with so much zeal in their package that you have to be careful about their descriptions of the evils of a particular accounting technique and that sort of thing. And the real goal is to make sure you understand it and then back off. In other words, the trick of writing about these complex story is to be credible to the expert, credible to the chief financial officer, but understandable to your reader. And this mix of how much the dumbed down word is not fair to this, but that's what we're talking about, is pulling your focus back so that you can write about the complexity and write about it with assurance. And you know enough that you can simplify with assurance, and that's really important. I see my wife, who's a scientist, she reads our scientific stories, and it irritates her that we skip over a lot of stuff, but she can't, we're not wrong, but in other words, it was worded so carefully that it's credible to the expert, and she can't tear it apart. Well, that's what I'd hope we do with accounting stories.
I think you may be interested. I had occasion recently for a corporate client of ours to have an associate of ours do a comparison of the press releases over a five-year period of the client with the way the reportage covered the financial results of the client on a quarterly basis. And the client, always putting net income down, also described at various times what it referred to as adjusted net income and core income, and the journal and other papers went right to the net income as the start, and then talked about whether things were better or worse on a comparative level. But I was struck by the inability of the press releases to overcome journalistic inquiry.
May I say just one thing in response to that? This is a very interesting point, because at base, just the basic earnings are the way that people compare all kinds of companies, and we've always devoted a lot of effort to making sure it was standard. We have gone with net income, and for Time Warner and people who do EBITDA and stuff like that, they really hate that. But in our absolute rule is net income has to be in the lead and has to come first. And the funny thing is Dow Jones now is reporting funny money and not net income, and so they don't like it very much when we take Dow Jones net income and make that the lead. But I think that shows that we're committed to trying to make that as comparable as possible.
Judith?
Okay, thank you. much of my experience, as you know, as you said, I've been mostly in print, so much of my experience is much like Barney's. And as a matter of fact, I want to tip my hat to two people in the room, Adam Liptak and Ken Vitter, who kept me honest and kept all of us honest when I was at the New York Times and Business Week, and I'm sure they're going to keep us all honest here today. But my experience is mostly drawn from print, and when I saw the title of this, I was reminded of a particular company in my years as editor at the Times that every time we wrote about them, practically, we would get a call the next day from the PR woman who had something to complain about, and we didn't understand their accounting. And often it wasn't just the PR woman who called, it was the CEO and the CFO wanted to come in and see us and explain their accounting to us because we clearly didn't get it and we were making all these kinds of mistakes. Well, that CEO and that CFO are now waiting to hear their fate from the jury. They were Dennis Kozlowski and Mark Schwartz. I can't tell you how many times they came to visit us in the back room of the business, this day conference room, and told us how we just didn't understand Tyco's accounting and, you know, Dennis never sold a share of stock, and it was amazing to me. And the second company that did that, it was equally aggressive, was Computer Associates, which is also under investigation. So if I really look back on my career at both, you know, the Times and Business Week, it hasn't happened that yet at CNBC, the companies that I found were most aggressive about telling us that we just didn't understand were the ones that we should have probably been more aggressive about, not less aggressive about. So to me, the answer to the question, does the media get business news, is most of the time. I mean, I'm sort of in agreement with Davia that I'd say 90% of the time I think we do get it. And I think that there are, I totally agree with Barney on the language of accounting is something that we all have to understand, not necessarily because of, you know, as what you were talking about, Floyd, but because that's how you ask the questions. You have to understand enough about accounting to ask, to find the places that you should be questioning about. It's an area that I think we do pretty well on, but no doubt we could all do better on, and we too are having things like seminars and people and experts that we go to, and there are people in the newsroom who are considered experts and that we encourage the younger reporters to go to. The other thing that I wanted to bring to the party, though, is that I don't think we've talked enough about editing. The editing process is, you know, it's not just the reporter whose biases and whose knowledge we're talking about here. Every place I've been has a rigorous editing process with layers of editing, and I think that is a thing that, you know, people we should explain more, and it cuts away at the biases that I think, or should cut away at the biases that I think that Davia mentioned. I also agree with Barney about the simpleness of things. I think sometimes we need to, and we do, this is what we try to do, we need to understand all the accounting procedures and methods, and even equally important, the way corporations work. I think we've got a lot of things wrong from time to time in the business media because we didn't understand what a board of directors really did as opposed to what corporate managers really did. And I wouldn't say wrong, drastically wrong, where we made a stock company, you know, come down, but just, you know, the nuance was maybe wrong. And I think that, however, we're beginning to understand that much more as that's become a bigger issue. I'd like to turn, actually, the question around to go back to my anecdote to begin with, and I wonder if the business gets media, not if media gets business world. I think sometimes that the media is criticized for not taking, you know, the word of a corporation when that may be their view, but we in the media have talked to many more constituencies to come up with that simple thought or to synthesize what the actual situation is. And I think that corporations get frustrated many times when we don't believe them. I think that I would argue that we haven't been aggressive enough. We've been too accepting of what corporations tell us, not the other way around. That's my point.
How can television cover matters as complex as we've been talking about?
It depends on what you're talking about. You're talking about accounting, that you spend time doing things like that on companies with accounting. Other times, we chop it up into the pieces. And or we go to the simple thought. We synthesize. You have to know a lot to get to the next level to synthesize it enough the way Barney was describing in Science News. When there is so much information, you really have to understand a lot of it to make it simple enough for the normal, you know, ordinary viewer to see. But don't forget also, CNBC has a pretty sophisticated audience.
I was going to ask you, is the CNBC audience significantly different in sophistication than the audience of the other of the journalistic print places that you've worked on in the past?
Not the three places. Certainly not Business Week or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But I think it's much more sophisticated than the general TV audience.
Is there a built-in bias in CNBC's coverage of the market?
I don't think so.
Ask a straight question. That's okay. That's good. Let me ask you all, is coverage of this subject substantively different than coverage of any other subject? I mean, is it just a different subject which maybe has a little higher level of complexity, or is it by its nature different in kind than covering, say, political matters?
I would like to answer, because I think it is substantively different in that arguably there is more of an objective truth when it comes to business news. I mean, you have results, you have bottom line, you have accounting statistics, you make your numbers, you don't make your numbers. Now, everybody obfuscates as much as they can within the corporate sector, and we all know that and we dance around it. But there is more of a there. And whereas in the political realm, it really all does, most of it revolve around what your point of view is. And thus, spin can be much more convincing. I think there is less room for spin, if you're honorable, in the business world, either in how you cover it or in how you present it.
I want to add a point. I think it's different from another way, too, and that is there are many more sources of information and many more people with pieces of the puzzle. You know, if you're talking about a corporation, you don't just get corporate information from going to the company itself and to a few analysts. If you really want to tell the story, you go to suppliers, you go to competitors, you go to customers, you go to people who've left the company and may have a view of things. There are many more places to get information that you can get a whole picture of the story. Whereas in politics, I don't think that's necessarily true, or in some other areas. Sports, you know, what do you got? You know, so I think it's more complex.
Barney, do you agree with Davia that there is a residue of truth, of knowledge, of fact in the business world, which is different in its nature than other areas of journalism?
I think it's different, yes. I think that I agree with what she said, and I think the specifics, the details that are out there, and then more importantly, I sort of alluded to what if you write a story and there's a result, something happens, the price of a stock goes down. It goes down a precise amount, and that registers within minutes. It can register within a day, whereas if you're writing about public policy, it may take longer for something to happen, unless you're talking about you're in the middle of a vote on the Hill and there's trading going on.
What sort of complaints do you get most? If you had to sort of quantify what it is people complain to the journal most about?
The biggest complaint by far is out of context. Headlines, which one would expect. It's the ultimate simplification of what we do. They get the most complaints in the area of context. We get complaints about using the numbers that we picked out of an SEC filing rather than what the company put in their press release. In other words, we told you what was important and you completely ignored that. And sometimes you do not completely ignore, but you look at what was filed at the SEC and give it more credibility than you do the press release. I think we get complaints, I'm sorry, I would have to say second after context is the reporter already had their mind made up. And I have to say, I think this is, I see a couple of 800-pound gorillas in our newsrooms. This is one of them, particularly as newspapers try to do more sophisticated coverage. And the New York Times, magazines have always done big feature-type stories. And all newspapers, and particularly the Journal, when you do this, you may invest weeks in a story. So you have a proposal process. And the reporter and their immediate editor propose this story. And if that story is approved, too often it becomes, in the eyes of the reporter, a contract. If I just deliver this, he can't turn me down. He's going to have to put it on the front page. That's it. We've got a deal. Well, that causes reporters to struggle and struggle to make the story fit the proposal. And great stories can go way off the proposal and end up being just fantastic. And so we have to keep educating our reporters. Keep talking to your editor as your story changes. Sometimes it'll fall off the bed, and then you stop work and everybody saves time. But this proposal process does cause people to come in. I've tried to talk about it as a working hypothesis. I mean, if people will think of it as being a little more flimsy than a contract with a page one editor, you're a lot better off. You do need to think about how you're going to approach it, but keep it flexible. And too often we don't.
Judith, what's your experience in terms of the sort of things which get most criticism by the entities being reported on and the most complaints?
At CNBC, I have to say there haven't been all that many complaints, and when there have been, there have been one or two examples of where we actually made a factual error, you know, and we corrected it immediately.
And in your former life?
In former lives, some of it was context. Some of it was you already had an idea to begin with. But I have to say, on the flip side of that, having been a reporter as well as an editor, I have talked to people when I'm at the beginning stages of a story, and they say, well, what's your take? And I say, I don't know. I don't have one yet. I'm just trying to gather information. And they get really upset. They don't want to talk to you unless they know what your take is. And so, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing a lot of the times. I've actually been told, well, come back to me when you have an idea of what you're going to write. I mean,
but that's because they don't believe you, and they think that you actually have an idea, but you're not telling.
But you wouldn't.
But there are some people who will use that as a
You've heard stories like that?
I have heard
David, what's your own experience and those of clients of yours? What is it they complain most about to you?
Well, I think that the idea, the 800-pound gorilla is, I'd say, 900 pounds. I'm gonna give you a little example that is so far away from now that it won't harm anybody who I'm working with now or have worked for. Many, many, many years ago, I was head of public affairs at Columbia Business School. Columbia Business School, it's this forum. And the New York Times was going to do a story on Columbia Business School. You know, this was like hitting the lotto. And we were all very excited about it. And the reporter came in. It was the first story she'd ever written for the New York Times. And she came in. The first words to me were, well, what are Harvard, Wharton, and Columbia? And I said, I don't know. What are they? And she said, two of the top business schools in the country and a country in Latin America.
Whoa.
Now, this is the first thing that she said after she was going to write a story about Columbia. And I thought, oh, okay. So, you know, I dragged her around and I took her to the dean. And I did this with all, you know, deference and honesty, knowing where we were strong and knowing where we weren't strong. And she talked to a million reporters and sat in classes and talk to students and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I had hoped that the reporting that we were number four, I mean, that she had done would have gotten her a little bit off the mark. Guess how that story started?
Yeah.
What are her, I mean, you know, don't let the facts interfere with my story. So, yeah.
Let's go to the audience. I'm sure people here have questions. Yes. Could you give your name and affiliation, please?
Yeah, Peter Thonis at Verizon. First of all, I would have been delighted to be on the panel if I'd been asked. Okay? And I'm a corporate executive.
Would you like to have a seat here?
And, you know, some of you know me, a lot of people in the room know me for various other reasons, but a couple of things, when you're talking about 800-pound gorillas, and I just want your perspective on this. I think that one of the things that I get frustrated about more than, I think stupidity, yeah, that happens, and when it happens, you go, you can't believe it, but I think that often the editors recognize that, too, when they see a reporter who's really off the mark, and if you make a complaint, usually, often, you'll get people to really understand they've got the wrong person, but I think the thing that bothers me more than that is conventional wisdom and the notion that reporters sometimes, and believe me, I believe fervently in this 90-10 rule. I mean, I think business journalism is incredibly above where it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I was at IBM 15, 20 years ago when it was really not very good at all. And if you look at a publication like the Wall Street Journal, for example, even 5 years ago, you had like 2 people covering telecom. Now you've got like 8, you know, so there's a lot more coverage and a lot more detailed, and generally we have good experiences. But the conventional wisdom thing always troubles me because it's part and parcel of what you're talking about here, because reporters have a tendency at times, if they see something that they get read enough times, they start believing it and they start talking about it as if it's always must be true, and companies get painted with a brush. Now I think as reporters now with the getting painted with a brush thing is starting to happen with Jason Blair. I think you can kind of, you know, recognize that as being a liability. But the at times we get painted with the brush that if there are bad corporations, bad actors like Enron, like WorldCom, therefore all corporations must be greedy. I saw something in the New York Times today where it literally said that it was a story about John Kerry, and it said something like, it made a point about corporations and consumers being two distinct thoughts. In other words, you're either on the side of consumers or on your side of corporations. Well, why is that? I mean, aren't there cases where corporations are on the side of consumers? That's how they sell products. Maybe not in every case, but certainly in some. But there's a tendency, I think, for reporters to use conventional wisdom and then paint everybody with a brush over and over and over again about corporate misdeeds, about any issue, how much corporate executives get paid, whatever. And it becomes something that gets thrown into stories and then over and over again gets repeated. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, Marty? He's talking about you.
I think that's a fair point. I guess the thing I would add is I believe it's a bigger danger for editors than for reporters. We're sitting in rooms in New York City thinking about industries and trends and the conventional wisdom we're more likely to fall for, I think, or to be trapped by, because we're trying to synthesize and think about how you can make the picture bigger, and we tend to deal in generalities which are often conventional wisdom, and then say, hey guys, let's go check this out, and so we have to bear part of the blame for that. I think that conventional wisdom is more rampant in politics than it is in business reporting, and I don't know about sports. I believe sports at one time was heavily freighted with conventional wisdom. I think it's less so today because there's some really bright sports writers and sports editors.
I agree with that completely, by the way. Let me just add one thing. It's more true in politics, but, you know, it's many reporters spend a lot of time trying to convince their editors that the other guy's reporting is all wrong and they're the ones who got the real story. So I don't think it's all that much a problem in business journalism. I think it's a problem in the other parts of papers.
Yes.
I was very Henry Stern. Of course, Henry Stern, New York Civic. A question from Ms. Tamman. I was very distressed about the story of the analyst who had a sale recommendation, and then they had him investigated. And they made up a misleading story. It got him fired from his job. What's happened to him? And what can be done? No, this is really bad.
Well, what's happened is that he has chosen the route of litigation against the people who instigated this whole thing, against the company that he was covering. And it's in the middle, so I can't tell you what's happened. I work with them. I do a lot of litigation kinds of issues that sometimes, you know, your biggest task is to not have something be known until it's the appropriate time to be known. And in this case, I can't really talk about it. You know,
timing is everything.
Timing is everything. And but he's fighting it. And but he had a choice whether to follow this up in the court of public opinion, or where he could get his vindication to his reputation, or whether he could follow it up in litigation and get some financial reward. And the guy's, you know, out on his own now, and so he chose financial remuneration because he needs it. He's got a family, and he's got to provide for them. So that's yet to be told, but it's an egregious story. And also, believe me, the deeper you get into any story, and that's what we all have to do, is bore down, then you find details that mitigate this and mitigate that. Nothing is ever that cut and dried, and this one isn't either, to be fair. But it is, it's got a point of view. So I can't tell you yet.
Yes, Marty.
I'm Marty Kroll. I'm on the business side of Daily News, U.S. News. I have a question about bias. We always hear a lot about the so-called liberal bias in the press. I'm wondering what you think. If you put aside the Journal and Business Week and CNBC and such, but the more mainstream press, is there an anti-business bias? I've always had the impression that because of the fact that journalism is not the most well-paying of professions, there's an envy and jealousy of the fact that people in business make a lot of money, and that motivates a lot of stories, and I'm interested in your views of that.
Interestingly enough, I think that the anti-business bias is more among journalists who are in politics and Metro and that sort of thing, not among business journalists. I think the only time when I think that there is some, I go back to Peter's mention about greed. Whether all corporations are greedy. The first thing that came to my mind, well, here we are in executive comp session, season, and 24 million pay packets are coming out every day. I think that's the one thing that some business journalists have a feeling about, that it's, not anti-business so much, but where's the line? Just how much are these executives worth?
Davey?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let me give you a case in point. This was a long time ago, but I was with a corporate CEO I was working for, who I don't know how many millions the guy made. It was, off the chart. And there was a reporter coming in, and from an unnamed publication, who I know made $19,000. And that reporter was interviewing the CEO of the company. And no matter how that reporter tried to be fair, the bias just seeped in. And to be honest, the CEO didn't help it along any. He wasn't like a regular guy. He didn't try to come down to that level. But I will say, I've seen sea changes, and I've seen three so far, and I guess if I live long enough, I'll see more. But when I first started in this business, late 70s, 80s, yes, I think there was a big bias against business. Then with all this dot-com nonsense, when every journalist could sort of envision him or herself in that world too, and it was all so jazzy, then I think it got to be a pro-business bias. Again, more of the gullibility eating it by whole. And if I have a dime for every arrogant CEO said, well, I just want to be on the cover of Business Week. Why can't you get me on? And it's not politic to say because you don't deserve to be there. So then it was a pro-business bias, and now obviously in the pendulum has swung, and I think it has turned anti. I think a lot of organizations right now don't want to come on because they don't want to raise their head. And I have said to people, in a firestorm, you don't stick your head up above the line of fire, you duck. So, there.
I think underneath this, or overarching, is the basic idea that reporters are skeptical of power, and I think quite appropriately. That's our job. It's too simple to use the old, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, but the idea of challenging power and being skeptical, not cynical, but skeptical, is a very important part of journalism. And I think that, therefore, business has, hopefully, that skepticism, but they also have a lot more information about the way their world that they're covering works. And so I think that mitigates a bit. I don't think that money has that much to do with it. I think up until up until the 1970. Washington Press Corps journalism in general was populated by guys from Midwestern land-grant schools like me. But after Watergate, guess what? We could hire Ivies right and left. They used to be going to the Foreign Service, but when they saw that Bob Woodward could bring down a government, this was a power game. And so what we have, in my opinion, is people who are coming from the best schools in the country and are interested in being journalists because they see there's power there, but they are operating with a confidence as well as a high level of competency that causes them to see a bit more of the power game in the way they do their journalism. And that's a kind of an interesting thing because it has many good aspects, but there's a confidence in that kind of talent that is now in the Washington Press Corps across all of our newsrooms. So I don't think the money and the salary is that big a factor.
But Barney, are they aware of their own power as well when you're talking about this power game?
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
David McDell from Journalism School. I want to ask you that you've made a transition from a weekly to a daily to an hourly.
I'm going to books next. Back to books.
I'm curious how that's affected the way you think about the audience, or the readership, or what kind of service you're providing, because certainly many viewers use CNBC kind of as a radio with a ticker on the bottom, and they got to take action immediately on what they see or perceive. So how has that changed your role as a journalist?
Well, I think we're doing both, or we're trying to do both. No question about it. People want the, you know, minute-to-minute, the ticker, the minute-to-minute news that's coming across the wires and other things. But I have tried to have us go in-depth on various things so that we're not just that kind of a service. We've done, long 10-piece parts on, we went to India, did outsourcing, did, segments on Indian companies becoming competitors to American companies, on the growth of India's middle class. We did a week-long series on new medical technology. So I think what I've been trying to do is give them both. Give them the minute-to-minute, day-by-day ticker news, but have in-depth reporting as well that's almost more magazine-y than, daily newspaper.
Yes.
Hi, this is on. I'm David Lieberman. I'm a media business reporter for USA Today, and this year I'm a Knight Badgett Fellow at Columbia. I've got a question for you, Davida. The research we hear at the Columbia Business School says that the more transparent companies are, the better their stock price will do. And it certainly strikes me that there'd be fewer errors if they were more open. Why don't executives believe that?
Well, first let me duck that one by just saying that the Knight Badgett program at Columbia, which I haven't mentioned, Terry Thompson, it is one of the programs that tries to teach business journalists accounting and really to understand journalism. I'm on the board of that. Terry Thompson is the executive director of it. And it is really one of the better programs out there to be able to produce a class of informed business journalists. I think that raises the bar for all of us. I don't know who says what is transparent and what isn't. After the Enron debacle, I was sitting with a very, very prominent, very smart business journalist, and he said that he had looked over Enron's income statements and 10-Ks and filings very, very closely, and darned if he could see, if he could have ever seen where this happened. They were so clever at hiding this stuff that he couldn't have seen it until he had known where to look. So I don't know who says what's clear and what isn't clear. I do know that for a lot of companies previously, and previous to this latest series of disasters, found that obfuscation worked. And it did work. And I can't go into, but it did. And I don't like it, and you don't like it, and I think none of us now like it, But believe me, for a while, it was quite likable. So, you know, I think that we all have an obligation to be able to do it. And really, the press must be doing this in an open-eyed and hard-hitting way to keep us all honest.
Yes, in the back. Yes.
I think it doesn't work the same way. It's interesting, we were talking earlier about how business journalism is better, you thought in some ways, but the local business press at one time was very much a boosterism kind of press, you know? And I think there's some remnants of that, but I think even, you know, local newspapers and TV stations now don't, you know, aren't boosterism most of the time. I don't think it works in business journalism because I think business people tend to read national, you know, publications and watch national TV.
I think the situation has been changing over the years, and I think one factor is the Society of American Business Editors and Writers. Mike Kandel, who's here today, has been a two-time president of that group. It was formed to have some business editors come together and say, let's stand up to the business side and the publishers of our newspapers and do bolder, better business journalism. And that organization has continued and most recently been involved with the foundations in taking seminars to within 75 miles of every newspaper that's a part of the Southern Newspaper Publishers Association and saying, you come for 2 days and we're going to have volunteers from the Society of American Business Editors and Writers, people from bigger newspapers, come and tell you how to cover business. Now, that arms them with some knowledge they didn't have before. It doesn't get them past their publisher in the smaller communities where the publisher is so integrated in the community. Those kinds of pressures continue to be a problem in covering powerful businesses at the local level. In other words, a small newspaper in Arkansas has got Walmart and Tyson, two huge stories right there, but wow, the pressure those companies exert in the communities is tremendous.
And is there any such pressure, any such equivalent by large American corporate advertisers on the press, the national press, the Wall Street Journal sort of press? Do companies ever come in and either overtly or covertly suggest that you are so persistently unfriendly to them that they really have to reconsider advertising?
Yes, and they have done it, and they have come back. One of the great lessons that you got when I joined the Journal in 1965 in the handout was a set of clips that related to events in the mid-1950s when the Journal wrote a story that General Motors didn't like. General Motors said, we are pulling our advertising, we're not going to talk to your reporters, and so you see an AP story about how this all started. And there was an explanation on the editorial page that we were simply trying to cover business for the whole world of investors. And then you see next an editorial that says, welcome back, General Motors. 6 months later, they had come back and started advertising and started talking to us again. When you're a young reporter, that says the biggest company in the world could not throttle your newspaper, and it gives you something in your gut that you never lose. Now, we've had other people, Herb Schmertz and Mobile, have pulled their ads. That's a more recent example. And it's something that we simply march ahead with. We have a certain advantage. Right now, we don't have very much advertising, but in the national scope of things, when we're not dependent on a department store the way some newspaper in St. Louis is. And so that's a plus. One other little thing, for a number of years, I don't think this is apocryphal, but for a number of years, and it would go back to when I joined the paper, the Wall Street Journal put aside a year's, Barney Kilgore, the father of the modern day Wall Street Journal, put aside a year's worth of operating expenses in a liquid account so that if all advertisers pulled their advertising for a year, the Wall Street Journal could continue to publish. That sends a great signal to your staff.
David?
I actually have a story just like this. It is a wonderful story, but not wonderful. When I first went to work at Citicorp as head of marketing for the investment bank, previously, and this was a long time ago, different regime, totally was in, there had been a story before I got there, which was in 1982 probably, that there had been a Citicorp employee in the investment side who had been a whistleblower, and he had found that the organization was parking funds in different countries but not paying taxes in those countries. And he whistleblew internally, and they actually started to do some stuff about it, but not enough for him. And they tried, and then Citi transferred him to Paris. But he didn't shut up, and he kept on going. And as with most whistleblowers, he had a little personality defect on top of it. So, it's that kind of a personality that will also often become a whistleblower. And so they fired him. And he then took his story to Fortune magazine about the firing. And it was such a compelling story that Fortune tried to get Citi to talk about it. And Citi took the posture that we won't say anything, we have no comment, we have no comment, we have no comment. So Fortune had no alternative but to run the story with this guy as its only source. And they actually took him, they took pictures of him at his local pool hall and his local cafe, and it was just an awful story. Citi was so angry that they told people that no one at Citicorp could talk to Fortune. We could not advertise in Fortune, and I ran the advertising budget. And if we were seen talking or advertising with anybody from Fortune, that was our job. Well, it took a change of regime to get that one to end. And I will tell you later, when I was talking to my friends at Fortune, they said to me, you know, this was so ridiculous, because there were a lot of editors at Fortune who were very questioning of this guy and his motives. And if they had have talked to Citi, and Citi would have said one thing that was questioning or negative in response, we probably wouldn't have run the article. So, you know, really, judgment is an important thing here.
I see my face has been blocked from seeing half of a whole table here. So, Mike.
I'm Mike Kandel with CNN and CNN-FN. I'd like to elaborate on a little bit of what Evan said about local coverage. It's interesting, local television does not cover business. You know, it's really interesting if our planet was destroyed and a couple of hundred years from now, people came from Mars, where all that salt water is, and they found one thing, which was a repository of local television tapes. And they say, wow, now we could find out what this lost civilization was all about. We'll watch their local news. And they'll say, there was a lot of crime. There was a great deal of weather. There was sports and there were celebrities, but how did these people make a living? No way on local television. And that's really sad. And I wonder, I've been telling young aspiring business journalists, go to local television, convince them that they want to cover business. It's such an important part of their communities. And local television has not done it. So I ask our esteemed panel, is there any hope for local television to get it?
Judith?
I agree with you. It's tough. I think every now and then they cover, I go home, I was born in Rochester. Every now and then you'll see something about Kodak on the local news, but it's usually a layoff or a reorganization or, you know, something like that. But as far as real general business, not unless it's a consumer, you know, a consumer angle. No, I don't think there's any hope for real general business.
Anyone else? Last question, yes.
I'm Catherine Fitzhugh, and I'm an avid CNBC watcher, and I'm curious to know how many of the on-air personalities actually do their own investigative reporting. When I read an article in a newspaper, I assume that the reporter has actually gone out and done the research, but I wonder about the on-air personalities.
Newspapers, TV is no question a collaborative medium, and do the people on the air, you mean the anchors, do they do investigative reporting? No, but they do some of their own reporting. They certainly do, you know, all their reading in, and they will call sources. They will, you know, trying to decide which questions to ask. They also have people who are helping them, who are, you know, somebody maybe who booked the guest will also suggest questions. But very often I found that even though when I suggest or somebody else suggests questions, they ignore me and ask their own questions anyway. So they do some. I wouldn't call it investigative. I would call it, you know, preparatory reporting, no question about that. Yeah.
You have any reaction, Barney? Is there any hope for local coverage?
Oh, for local television, I really don't think so, Mike. it seems to me that the technology's there to do it on cable or on the web, but it's the question of who's going to support local business reporting. And really, local business reporting has to be really economically healthy. That's what can make great business journalism. If you're weak economically, your business journalism, I think if you could deduce that from some of the things that have been said, certainly some things I've said. So it has to be strong economically, or it's vulnerable, and its credibility suffers if it's too weak and it's always struggling to find out where it's going to meet next week's payroll. And that will be a problem if you took it to the niche level, even though the technology's there.
How about local newspaper reporting of business as opposed to television coverage of business? Is there room, you think, in the future for more coverage, not boosterism, but more coverage?
I think local newspapers, which may themselves eventually morph to the web, assuming we all find out how the ad revenue model can work on the web, but local newspapers are the strongest part of the business right now in general. And so local newspapers are healthy, and even though they're vulnerable to the local department store, and even though the publisher sits on the board of the bank and things like that, they have the capability to do decent reporting of their community, and then pull in from other services the broader economic interpretation and statistics.
Davia, what's the future of business coverage in America?
Well, if we get more and more Knight Badgetts around, it's going to be pretty rosy. But I do think that the mechanism for feedback needs to be a little bit easier and clearer, and with less fear of retribution.
Yes.
And I really do think that will help raise the bar even higher.
Well, I want to thank the panel for this sparkling presentation. Thank you all very much.